Oh, there we are. Good morning, Council. How are you today?
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
I'll ask the marshal just to recall the calendar for today and we will proceed.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Werke, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Diane Bradfold presiding.
All right, and I'll just make just a couple of quick remarks before we go ahead. First of all, I really appreciate Council being here early and ready to go. It's helpful to us to stay on time, and in fact, early today for this argument. So we have a total of six matters on our calendar today. This is our second oral matter. I'll have the marshal call the file number so that our oral record is clear, and then I'll make just another couple of quick reminders to Council before we start.
Calling A20-0223, State of Minnesota versus Daniel Joseph Creasel.
All right, and I think Council knows this, but it's always helpful to be reminded to do things. So we are recording today's proceedings. They are available on the website. So I ask you to start your argument by identifying yourself as well as the client you represent. And then the second thing is for you to keep an eye on the clock. The marshal will make it visible. It should be, yeah, there we go. We've got the 15 minutes visible right now. That should be visible to you as well. Now, I overlooked something. I did hear you doing an audio check earlier with our clerk. And so I want to make sure that that is still in effect. So I tell you what I'll do. I'll ask, it's Ms. Heinrich, right? Counsel for appellant. Do I say your last name correctly?
That is correct. Thank you.
Okay. And we can hear you. I can hear you just fine. Can you hear us?
I can. Thanks.
All right. And then of course, I assume during proceedings, if something goes awry, you'll let us know and you know how to do that. And Mr. Stummy, if you would check your audio as well.
Yes. Good morning. I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. And is it Stummy? Am I saying that right?
It is Stummy. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. All right. So with that, I think we are ready. Counsel for appellant, you've got the clock, you know, that time goes quickly and we're ready to listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. The clock doesn't appear to be moving, so maybe, oh, here we go.
There we go.
Good morning. My name is Laura Heinrich, and I represent Daniel Creasel, the appellant in this case. There are two categories of argument that are on appeal in the arguments made in the brief and what I'll be addressing today. One is a standalone issue of a biased juror sitting in judgment of the case, which creates a structural error and requires reversal all on its own. The second category of arguments is really the problems associated with the state proceeding to trial on a first-degree assault without calling a single medical care provider, without calling the complaining witness, or presenting any evidence of what happened to the complaining witness after the day of the assault. A first-degree assault requires the state to prove great bodily harm. Great bodily harm is determined by the seriousness and endurance of the injury for either a theory of serious permanent disfigurement or a theory of other serious bodily harm. The record here is insufficient to prove either, and thus the first degree assault conviction must be vacated. There are a number of constitutional and evidentiary rulings that are related to those. While there are a number of issues in this case, time is brief, so I'm not going to address those specifically, but if there are any questions, please feel free to interrupt me and ask. As to the presence of a single biased juror, I'll refer to the juror as JB, as I did in my brief as well. Under the case law and the rule, Minnesota Rule of Criminal Procedure 2602, Subdivision 2, the presence of a single biased juror is structural error and undermines the right to a fair trial.
You're acknowledging and accepting that you have the burden of proof on this to show that the juror was biased?
I do acknowledge that the actual bias, the burden of proof is on us the appellant.
My question for you then is, obviously the panel has reviewed the record. There was a lot of statements by juror JB that, you know, that's a tough one. I would try hard and so on. And to me, that's all probative of bias, but what was actually said that demonstrated bias? I mean, we move beyond probative bias, the judge rehabilitated or attempted to. What is your strongest statement that show actual bias?
I think the part that's actual bias is that the juror would have to represent that they could fairly evaluate all the evidence in the trial and protect the substantial rights of the parties. And here we have a juror who first says, I don't really like graphic evidence. It makes me very emotional.
Are you saying that those statements are indicative of actual bias?
It's the beginning of her actual bias. She starts
What I'm asking you is if you can pull out for us and share with us one or more actual bias statements that were made by her.
What she stated is she wasn't sure if she could wait till the end of all of the evidence being brought in before she would make a decision about whether or not Mr. Creasel was guilty of the crime. She essentially said if she saw a video of someone having been assaulted, she's not sure she'd be able to wait to look at anything else, and that might be enough just for her to have seen someone assaulted to then to overcome any type of presumption of innocence she's supposed to hold on to until she's seen all the evidence. That's where she starts to talk a lot about, I'll try, I'm not so sure, that's a tough one. She continues to say she's not sure she could continue to look at the other evidence and presume Mr. Creasel innocent until the end of the case and all the evidence is in.
Is that, in your opinion, the strongest example that you have?
Yes, I think it is the strongest example. I think the issue is ultimately the substantial right of being presumed innocent throughout the trial until all the evidence is in. She basically says, if I see somebody who's been assaulted, I'm not going to be able to look anything else. I'm going to leap to the conclusion that it was Mr. Creasel, and I'm not sure I could continue to listen to the other evidence. And that's what the question actually with the state brought out in over and over again as the state was trying to rehabilitate her. She continued to interrupt and say, I'm not going to like that I've seen someone be assaulted. I'm not sure that I can hold off to make a decision. And I'm not sure I wouldn't just jump to the conclusion. She at no point says she'd be able to. And she was never even asked if she was instructed she had to. Would that in fact make her be able to if she knew that this was one of the orders in the court? They never quite got there. She just kept saying, I'm not sure I could do that. That's a tough one. I think that is the actual bias, is that she'd see the video and wouldn't listen to the rest of the evidence in the case and wouldn't continue to presume Mr. Creasel innocent until all of the evidence is brought in. So given that she at no point notes that she could do these things, I don't think we get to even, I think there is actual bias based on that. And then when you get to part two of the inquiry, there's sort of two parts to that second part of the inquiry, which is both that she has said she could be impartial, and then whether the impartiality should be believed. And I think that's where the deference comes to the district court, is whether her assertions of being impartial should be believed because of the way she presented in court, or how she came across, all of the things that a district court is uniquely situated to be able to evaluate because they actually see the person. But we never get to the point that she says that she could be impartial. She just says she would try really hard. And I ultimately think the cases that are cited in the brief support that her language is not enough. But I also had a supplemental authority that I submitted, which is an unpublished opinion, State v. Bergendahl, where ultimately I think the juror there is saying the same thing. I want to be able to do this, but I'm not sure that I can. And ultimately, I think that's exactly what JB says, is that she wants to be able to be fair to both sides. She wants to be able to sit on this jury, but she's not sure she can presume Mr. Creasel innocent and listen to all the evidence if there's going to be a graphic video of an assault. And ultimately, that is what was presented here, is there's a graphic video that's presented to the jurors right after an assault. And if she's not going to listen to any of the rest of the evidence in the case after that, that's a major problem in terms of the fairness of this trial for Mr. Creasel. I would also note that the state's responses that they refer to in their brief are to the first questions that are asked of JB. So when they say she can be fair to both sides and that she'd be emotional, but it wouldn't be overwhelming to her, that was simply about graphic videos in general. When the questioning became much more specific about whether after seeing a graphic image of an assault or the aftermath of an assault, would you continue to be able to wait until the end of the trial to be able to make an evaluation? That's where she says, I don't know that I can. I think that would be tough. I might not be able to presume him innocent. That's at that point, she isn't answering the things like, I'd be fair to both sides or I wouldn't be overwhelmed. So for those reasons, I think there has been structural error in this case by allowing her to continue as a person who sat on the jury and should be reversed on that base alone. In terms of the sufficiency of the evidence here, I'd first argue that it's a circumstantial evidence standard of review for both theories of trying to prove the first degree assault, because they're both asking the jury to sort of make speculation or assumption based on evidence from the day of as to how the condition of the complaining witness is today. So the first degree assault statute requires the state to prove serious great bodily harm. And great bodily harm is defined as the type of harm that is either creating a high probability of death, that's the first way of going forward to trial, two, injury causes serious permanent disfigurement.
Just so we're clear, Ms. Heinrich, will you acknowledge that the conviction for domestic assault would not require that determination?
Yes, and the argument in terms of the domestic assault sufficiency of the evidence is not about circumstantial evidence. It was simply that there was no evidence in the record about the relationship between Mr. Creasel and the complaining witness at any point about whether they lived together, had a past romantic relationship, if there was a romantic relationship. The only thing the state pointed to in their brief as to the relationship between Mr. Creasel and the complaining witness was a statement made by counsel before the case even started, when everybody assumed that the complaining witness was going to testify.
My question for you then on the first degree assault is let's focus on the ear. That's the big thing the state is focusing on too. The actual, as I understand the evidence, the actual, I don't want to call it an ear, parts of the ear, flesh, I don't know, matter, skin, something, that's still there. It's still in possession of law enforcement as far as a piece of evidence, isn't it?
There was testimony from a police officer that they believed that the piece of flesh that they had in custody was from the complaining witness's ear.
Why would the fact that the body part is still in existence, why would that not be enough to show permanent disfigurement?
Well, let's start with
you didn't put it back on.
I understand. It wasn't reattached. But ultimately, the question of whether it was serious and persistent is, what does it look like now? What we do know is there's testimony from both, I don't think I'm going to pronounce this officer's name right, but Sarah Shute, Officer Shute, as well as Officer...
Now, Mr. Stumi and I would say that's Shooty, because Shooty. We always pronounce those E's as Hardee's. I'm just telling you, that's...
Okay, so from Officer Shooty, as well as one of the other officers whose name is escaping me right now, about ultimately that she had been scheduled for reparative surgery. So we know that she was scheduled for plastic surgery the next day or the day after. We also know that she was in the hospital for what they thought to be two more days.
Do you have any case law that supports that position? Because of course there's case law that says if you lose a tooth, that's enough. And a tooth is certainly something that's easier to put in and, I mean, replace than a portion of ear. So what case would you rely on to support that?
Well, the cases that I relied on in my brief, including Gerard and McDaniel and Beau, are all about the extent of the injury after the fact when there's been some kind of reparation. So there's scars because there's been some kind of surgery, or dye, there's scar because there's some kind of surgery. You have here the same thing, where she would be having surgery and ultimately the scar, or whether or not it's disfigured after the surgery, would be what the jury needs to evaluate as to the seriousness and the extent of the injury. We don't know because it's not in the record. What we do know from the court's record is that she did actually have this reparative surgery that wasn't presented to the jury, but we know she did have the plastic surgery and she may look just fine. And at that point, I'm not sure that the state that can argue that just because part of her skin, which we're not sure the extent of, it wasn't, I mean, there's a picture of it, but it's not presented to the jury. And we know her entire ear clearly was not taken off. And from the pictures, it looks like there's some injury, but we also don't know that it wouldn't have just grown back with a scar, and the seriousness and extent of the scar would have been the issue, or given here that she had surgery, the seriousness extent of the scar from the surgery would be what the jury needs to evaluate as to whether or not this is serious and permanent disfigurement. Also, that in terms of how much you could see the scar, also what, if any, ongoing serious medical issues she had. Unfortunately, the medical record that was presented, which I am not conceding should have been presented, I think there are arguments in the brief that it was problematic under any of the hearsay exceptions to let that in. But the medical record itself doesn't talk about what happened to her. It's more a description of what the injuries were on that day. It doesn't talk about what medical procedures were performed. And there's nothing to suggest from that that she didn't heal quickly or wasn't doing fine within a certain period of time. And ultimately, the difference between a third degree assault and a first degree assault is whether some temporary injury heals. So while the statement—
You brought this up, so I need to ask this question. Why was a judgment of conviction entered on that third degree, on the third degree assault?
Why was the judgment of conviction?
Wouldn't that be a lesser included?
Yes, and that would be, it should be, it shouldn't have been entered as a judgment of conviction on the third degree, given that it is a lesser included. Although there was an ask for that particular count by defense counsel, the jury came back with guilty verdicts on all counts. And ultimately, that would be an error for that to be an additional conviction.
I understand that's not in your brief, but I was just curious.
Yeah, I don't know of any case law that would distinguish that as having a separate, given it's a lesser included, having a separate conviction. So here, I think what the state did present was third degree assault, not first degree assault without this additional information. And the fact that there's some little portion of her skin in custody doesn't change that they have to show how she's doing now. She could be fine now. And the case law I cited before when asked about scars and the nature of the injury today would apply in this situation as well. There's no principal distinction between a situation like this and a situation where someone has a cut or a part of them gets hurt and they have surgery. And I see my time has elapsed and I reserve the last five for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Heinrich. You do, of course, have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I think with that, we have the clock reset. And Mr. Stumme, we're ready for respondent's argument when you are.
Thank you. This is Nathaniel Stumme. I'm with the St. Louis County Attorney's Office representing the state of Minnesota respondent. I'll start with the issue of the juror, JB. This was, an adult Caucasian appearing woman of middle age. She initially began her initial statements of apprehension about being a juror was at the discovery that there was going to be graphic evidence in this case. She said that she, although she likes to watch crime show mysteries, graphic, gory depictions, she needs to turn away. She's squeamish about those things. Her apprehension had nothing to do with actual bias against either the state or Mr. Kreisel in this case. Her main concern seemed to simply be having to look at gory evidence. She made no expression of, if I see gory evidence, I'm going to hold that against the defendant. If I see gory evidence, I'm going to hold that against the state. It was simply a question of her squeamishness and whether or not she would be able to pay attention and focus on the evidence and not turn away. She was rehabilitated. She agreed that she would have to look at the evidence. She said that she thought that she could be fair to both sides. She indicated that she would try really hard. She never made any statement to the effect of, I would try very hard, but I don't think I can do it. That's very, very much of a different expression than saying, I think I can do it. I will do my best.
Mr. Stumme, what about appellant's argument that JB indicated that she wasn't sure she could wait until the end, and that reflects an inability to follow the presumption of innocence?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the actual transcript reflects that expression on the part of JB, and so I would rely on the transcript for that. But I think that's an inaccurate statement, inaccurate characterization of JB's statement. Of course, in the case of determining a juror's qualifications to serve, this is an area where the case law indicates that deference to the trial court is not only great, it's at its pinnacle. And Judge Neo.
So let me just go back to that, because I'm trying to make sure I follow your response to the appellant's argument. So here's the way I, you know, and you're right, this voir dire of the juror does go on for some time, so I might be missing something or have it out of context. But there was a question at some point about graphic evidence and would the juror JB jump to conclusions? And I think her answer was something like, that's the tough part, I can't say for sure.
It is, Your Honor.
What's your response? I think that is at least in part the comment that appellant's relying on. So if you just give me your take on it, thank you.
Yes, I think you're referring to this transcript where I say, quote, just the graphic nature of the picture or video, would that make you jump to any conclusions that would be cut in stone? And then JB responds, that's the tough part, I can't say for sure. And again, Your Honor, what the point that I would like to make is that she says it would be the tough part about jumping to conclusions, but she doesn't say that those conclusions would be favorable to the state or favorable to the defendant. Certainly there are cases where jurors are going to see graphic, gory evidence that is presented by the defendant in his defense. And so I think her focus was just on how am I going to deal with gory evidence, and not that I have any preconceived notions or judgment or bias against either party. That's how I would respond. Great deference should be given to Judge Neo's conclusions that JB was actually, Judge Neo does not comment on whether or not JB was actually biased, but comments that she is a qualified juror. Judge Neo says that she was found to be forthright. Judge Neo actually cites Fraga, actually comments on the dynamic of Minnesota Nice, where jurors being questioned will often be self-deprecating. They will be humble. They will say things like, I will do my best, I will try hard. And Judge Neo understands that those types of expressions, in combination with the demeanor that they present, can combine to conclude that the jurors are qualified and not biased and perfectly capable of being objective. Again, Judge Neo found that she was forthright. Judge Neo says that Judge Neo observed JB's demeanor and came to a credibility determination that the issue of the gory evidence would not disqualify this juror. If I could move on to the elements of first degree assault.
Mr. Semmy, how do you respond to Ms. Heinrich's argument that there's no evidence of the victim's current state?
I would respond by saying the circumstances of a actual physical loss of the physical piece of a victim's body is a separate category of injury. If we are talking about a laceration, a cut, then the passage of time is going to be very probative of how permanent, how disfiguring that injury would be. Similarly, internal injuries, the passage of time, medical testimony as to the loss of use or function of those bodily parts will be probative. But when a person's body is dismembered, when they lose the tip of a finger, when they lose a tooth, when they lose an ear, and none of it is reattached with the original body part, that is permanent and it is disfiguring. This is a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And of course, this court is obliged to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. The evidence was that the piece of ear that was found by the investigator on the floor was approximately 1.5 to 2 inches long and 1/4 inch wide. The jury was allowed to see blown up color pictures of both Ms. Durant's ear and the piece of ear that was found in her home. I think the court has to conclude that the jury, if they saw this in the light most favorable to the state, could easily conclude that this injury was permanent and it was clearly disfiguring.
How do you respond to Judge Werke's question to Ms. Heinrich about the fact that the judge convicted on both the first and the third degree assaults?
I guess I don't know what the proper response is. I know that the third degree charge was requested by defense as a lesser included. That might have been a mistake to enter judgment of conviction. I'd like to move on to the statements. This was a case where law enforcement responded to a neighbor's 911 call indicating yelling in a home, and that's all that law enforcement knew. Sergeant Radloff arrived. He himself heard yelling. Soon afterwards, Ms. Durant comes running out of the home, not wearing a shirt, only a bra. She's bloodied and battered. Her face is full of blood. She's crying. She's hysterical. Sergeant Radloff calls her over to where he is at the side of the house. He has no idea what's going on. He does have his body camera on. And so we get to see what happens here. The court decided that the exchange that they had did not present a Crawford Sixth Amendment confrontation right problem, because the court determined that the exchange was non-testimonial. And the court did that because the primary focus of the information that Ms. Durant provided to Sergeant Radloff and the primary focus of Sergeant Radloff's questioning of her was to meet the challenges of an ongoing emergency. Sergeant Radloff did not know how many people were in the home, did not know how these injuries had been inflicted, by whom, how many other people were in the home, if there were other victims, what weapons, if any, had been used. It was, it bore all of the hallmarks of a chaotic situation. Now, at some point during their exchange, Mr. Kreisel does exit the home. He makes his way to the street where another officer, a backup officer, gets him prone on the street. And so he is relatively neutralized. But still, that does not end this emergency situation. And the case law, especially the case of the Bryant, indicates that the medical condition of the declarant, in this case, Ms. Durant, the victim, her medical condition needs to be taken into consideration on what was the primary focus of the information that she was conveying to Sergeant Radloff. And I would assert to you that from her perspective, the emergency was certainly ongoing. She was seeking help. She had just escaped her home. She was seeking refuge, was giving Sergeant Radloff that information that he asked for in an attempt both to assess her medical needs and to seek refuge and safety. The Bryant case talks about whether or not a declarant who is suffering from serious medical injury can even form any intent, let alone the type of testimonial intent that we're analyzing when we talk about the confrontation right. This, all of the descriptors, all of the adjectives that we could use to describe this encounter would be those that set it apart from the type of formalized, structured, calm, focused scenarios where we have to conclude the information that is being conveyed is for the purpose of establishing or proving a past fact to be used at a criminal trial. Everything about her statements to Sergeant Radloff, to the ambulance crew, and to the ER professionals had nothing to do with an intent to establish, to substitute the need for trial testimony. It was, all of it was non-testimonial, and all of it very squarely fit into acceptable, long-standing categories of exception to the hearsay rules. I have about 19 seconds left, so if I missed something that the court would like to ask, now's the time.
Looks like the panel doesn't have any questions for you, Mr. Stemme. And of course, as you noted, everything has been fully briefed for the court as well. So
thank you
very much. I see that the clock has been reset to 5 minutes for rebuttal. So Ms. Heinrich, we're ready for you when you are.
Thank you. I did want to address a couple of things that Mr. Stemme just brought up, or Stemme just brought up. First, I wanted to give the full exchange between Mr. Stemme and JB from the transcript. I would direct the court to pages 127 through 28 of the transcript. It's also cited in my brief on page 8. Mr. Stemme stopped with, "That's the tough part, I can't say for sure," after the cut and stone question. The follow-up question, however, from her, because she starts to engage, not even being asked, is, "You know, if I saw somebody who was beat up by somebody, I would probably think, you know, I would think, okay, this guy beat this guy up. So yes, of course, I'm not going to be happy with the person that beat him up." And then Mr. Stemme says, "Would you be able to hold," and she interrupts, "believe that he didn't do it?" And then Mr. Stemme continues, "Would you be able to hold off on making a final judgment till the very end of the case after you've seen and heard everything?" And she says, "I would try really hard." At that point, I don't think this is a question of being fair to either side. It's being fair to the person that's being accused. And that's fairly clear from context. The same is in the questioning from Mr. Schmid to JB on the transcript on page 125. He's asking specifically, "Can you be fair to Mr. Kreisel and hold him innocent after seeing something that's very graphic?" Again, JB says, "That's a tough one. I maybe could, I can't give you a," and then she sort of stutters out, "I can't give him a percentage." So she is talking about being fair to Mr. Kreisel, not just generally being fair. And there was more to that exchange about being able to hold off on her determination of whether or not the state had proved his guilt until the end of the trial, rather than right after seeing the graphic photographs or the graphic video. I'd also note that the standard that Mr. Stemme is talking about is not quite correct. Things like I think, or I'll try, or it'll be really hard, I'm not sure, those are not unequivocal. And again, I would point the court to the answers that were given in Bergdahl, and also the listing of the ways that would be insufficient in Rice v. State, which is cited in the brief. That's the first part. The second thing I wanted to address is the standard in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence. I would note that I argue that it's a circumstantial evidence standard, which changes things a little bit, in that the court determines what was necessarily proven, but then looks at whether there's reasonable inference that can be drawn from the circumstances proved support a rational inference other than guilt. And it must be inconsistent with any reasonable inference other than guilt. So So basically, because we don't have an actual image or anything for the jury to look at as to how she's doing now and whether the injury is permanent and continuing, you have them making inferences. Because we have in the record, both from Officer Schutte, as well as Officer Stoli is the name of the other officer who testified to the surgery that had been scheduled, the court has to look at this with sort of a heightened scrutiny standard. And there is an inference here that she looks fine, that she had surgery, that it's completely fine. And that would be the same for any other type of significant laceration. It's a significant laceration to her ear. Yes, part of it came off, but ultimately we're not talking about like a dismemberment the way that Mr. Stoemie is characterizing it. It's not that her whole ear isn't off, her whole arm isn't off. We have something that was able to be, at least from the record that we have, was able to be addressed with some skin grafting, which is not the same thing as being dismembered. So under the circumstantial evidence standard, I would note that we don't have enough here that there isn't an inference that she is not having this serious and permanent disfigurement at this point in time. For the reasons addressed today, and for all of the other reasons that are presented in the brief, and specifically, I would note that there's quite a bit of discussion in the brief about how this was not an ongoing emergency, that at the time these discussions were happening, Mr. Creasel was in custody, that there was evidence from Officer Radloff stating that there was no rush to have anything happen, that there was evidence that there was nobody else in the house, and we have no evidence that was ever presented that there was any allegation that there was a weapon that would treat this as a public emergency, like a gun that could be running around, versus a private emergency that was ended at the point that Mr. Creasel was put into custody. I think that Mr. Creasel's case needs to be reversed and sent back to district court. And one final point, if I may finish, I see my time has elapsed. One final point I wanted to note is that Mr. Stoemie brought up that it's the intention of what the complaining witness was saying, but actually the intention is the intention of the questioning officers. So it's whether or not they're collecting evidence to then present in court, not whether Mr. Ant or the complaining witness is providing evidence that she thinks is going to be used in court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So thank you to both lawyers in today's case. We very much appreciate the arguments that you've presented today, as well as the briefing that you've submitted to the court. So with that, this appeal is now submitted to us for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. So that concludes the second oral argument on our calendar today.